we're moving the agenda around a little bit, so we're going to start with item number 9, ocean ranching, which a visual says it all. But so with that, Chad, it's all downhill.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Smith and Vice Chair Carpenter and Commissioners, Director Unsworth. My name is Chad Herring. I'm a Willapa Bay Policy Implementation Biologist, and I'll be talking about ocean ranching today. Picture is just a tribute to Steve Thiesfeld. He found this picture, and so he's with us in spirit. I wanted to keep that in there. So, I'll give a brief overview of what I'll be talking about today. I'm going to provide some background information on ocean ranching, some programs from around the world, Japan, Norway, and then get into some programs here on the West Coast, Alaska and Oregon. I'll talk about some of the applicable RCWs that apply to ocean ranching. I'll discuss some of the potential benefits and as well as some of the potential issues, and then kind of summarize that up at the end. So when I first received this topic, I wasn't exactly sure. Ocean ranching, okay, what does that exactly mean? So a quick Wikipedia search directed me right away to the aquaculture page, and so that's defined as the cultivation of marine organisms under controlled conditions. Very broad definition. In fact, this topic is so big, there's been a number of international symposiums that have been held on stock assessment or stock enhancement and sea ranching. The first one held in 1997. The last was just held in 2015. So some of the things that in the literature that are relevant to ocean ranching, this term can be used for either stocking, restocking, stock enhancement, supplementation, sea ranching, sea farming, reseeding, culture-based fisheries, or enhancement. And these could all be kind of used interchangeably. In the third symposium that happened in 2008, a researcher named Bell proposed some definitions for that. And he wanted to split that up into three different categories: restocking, stock enhancement, and sea ranching, where restocking would be the release of cultured juveniles into wild populations to restore severely depleted spawning biomass to a level where it can provide regular substantial yields, or to help restore endangered or threatened species. Stock enhancement, the proposed definition, was the release of cultured juveniles into wild populations to augment the natural supply of juveniles and optimize harvest by overcoming recruitment limitations. Sea ranching, he wanted to define as the release of cultured individuals into unenclosed marine and estuarine environments for harvest at a larger size and put, grow, and take operations. And that's the definition that I'm going to move forward with today. So some form of ocean ranching is used extensively around the world. At latest count that I could find, there were 70 countries stocking over 180 species worldwide. Obviously, that number is constantly evolving and changing as programs come and go. The biggest by far in the world is Japan, which has presently 90 species ranched or researched for eventual stocking. Norway, along with their substantial salmonid program, also has programs for cod, European lobster, and some shellfish. Countries such as Australia stocking barramundi, and even countries like Iran, it has a sturgeon program into the Caspian Sea. Here in the U.S., we have multiple programs for multiple different species, the biggest of which is Pacific salmon, and salmonids are the most widely grouped stock of fish throughout the world. So I'll talk a little bit about the structure of Japan's program. It's kind of housed under the umbrella of the Japan Sea Farming Association. Underneath that, they have 16 national sea farming centers. These centers, which in collaboration with research entities and federal agencies as well as the universities, develop the species and method for what species may be stocked. These centers are subsidized by the national government. Underneath the national sea farming centers, then you have the regional sea farming centers. These centers are responsible for the production and release of juveniles. They're funded primarily by fishermen co-op associations, local governments, and landing tax that's assessed to the commercial fishers. There's also some local and local sea farming organizations and co-op association centers, but they mainly produce sedentary species, and they recoup their expenses through the sale of juveniles to the co-op associations. Japan controls the sea farming pretty rigorously. They limit effort. They have size restrictions, and all that is based regionally. There is there's a difference of opinion in terms of how effective these programs are and their interactions with natural populations. So there's kind of researchers on both sides of the fence here whether this is appropriate or not appropriate. And I think the really defining is it's really unclear at this point in time. There is a push in Japan for a bigger role for the fishermen to come forward in terms of some of the cost and running these programs. But generally worldwide, these programs are considered successful. So now I'll talk a little bit about Norway. The Norwegian Sea Ranching Program, or PUSH, and I won't butcher the Norwegian language by trying to say what that is in Norwegian. They had a program between 1990 and 1997. The purpose of that program was to research the biological and economic basis of sea ranching for profit. They looked at primarily four species: Atlantic salmon, Arctic char, cod, and European lobster. The economic analysis was done. It was NPV analysis, or what's considered net present value. So what that means is it's not a cost-benefit analysis. It doesn't have the multipliers out. It's basically just a strict analysis of the cost of the programs and what they reap back in terms of harvest. These were all four of these species, based on this assessment, were considered to be not economically feasible. The reasons for that were return rates were just too low. And the juvenile costs in terms of startup costs and everything were just too costly. So they do continue to have some stock enhancement programs for Atlantic salmon, cod, European lobster, halibut, and some other species. The salmon ranching in Alaska, first established in 1971, via the Division of Fisheries Rehabilitation and Enhancement and Development, or FRED. The first ocean ranching programs were established in 1974, and the purpose of this was the purpose of FRED was to manage the state hatcheries and promote private hatcheries. FRED was merged with the Division of Commercial Fisheries in 1993. Most of the hatchery work that's done in Alaska is done through private nonprofit hatcheries. In 2014, there were 31 private nonprofit hatcheries that released fish, 3 federal and only 2 state hatcheries. Most of the funding for these private nonprofit hatcheries came initially from a couple of different sources. One was the Enhancement Revolving Loan Fund that primarily funded most of the initial startup costs. They could also apply for grants to start some of these facilities. Some of the recent information I could uncover about the economics of this was is in terms of the initial investment from the loan fund, still about 90% of those funds are still outstanding to date. Now, whether Alaska is actively seeking to recover those expenses or not, I'm not sure, but the point being that they still haven't recouped the money from their initial investment. In terms of operating expenses and how that operates moving forward, they have these fisheries are they have a oh, crap. Sorry, I misplaced my notes. I was a little rushed here. So any fish that are released are able to be encountered in any of the commercial, recreational, or other fisheries that are out there. And then they also have what's called special harvest areas. And that's places for where that specific co-op association can try and recoup some of the expenses for hatchery production. And then they also recoup some of those expenses with the returns directly to the hatchery themselves. So a lot of numbers on this graph. There's some arrows and different colors and things. The thing that's important there is in 1974, you see that's when the harvest was at its lowest. That's when ocean ranching kind of came to be. You can see the harvest increasing since that point in time and kind of culminating there, and the yellow arrow is pointing to that. That in 2013, 283 million salmon were estimated to be harvested. 112 million, or 40% of that, were from their hatchery programs or ocean ranching programs. So a substantial amount. There is some contradiction out there about whether these operations are economically viable. As I mentioned earlier, some of the costs, initial startup costs, have yet to be recouped. But from a harvest-based standpoint, it did increase catch. There's still some contradiction in the literature about whether the impacts to the hatchery and wild interactions that are associated with these programs and still a need for more monitoring and evaluation. And secondly, we've kind of there's been a depressed market for hatchery fish recently, so that has led to some of what people conceive maybe is the economic viability of these programs. So there was some programs in Oregon, salmon ranching in Oregon. These were operated as private for-profit hatcheries. At its peak, there were 12 sites located up and down the coast. They released Chinook, Coho, Chum, and Pink salmon. And different from the Alaskan model, where they had special harvest areas where they could try and recoup these expenses, most of the fish were harvested upon return to the facility. So they didn't actively go out and get them. They waited for the fish to come back to the facility, and they were harvested there. None of these facilities are currently in operation. Issues that were cited with were prior interception. None of these facilities ever really got to the point where they were starting to turn a decent profit. There were a lot of pressure in terms of the impacts to natural origin fish, in terms of straying and genetic issues. And also there was kind of a changing political climate associated with ocean ranching for profit in Oregon. So we have a little bit of history of salmon culture external to the agency in Willapa Bay. Part of what we currently have going on is RFEGs, or Regional Fisheries Enhancement Groups, and some volunteer cooperatives identified in the 2016 Future Brood document. These numbers will be expressed in terms of eggs that we will give to these programs. This year, it's identified as 200,000 chum and 1.5 million coho. Keep in mind that these are targets, and not every year is this total production reached. We also have a history of – oh, sorry, I skipped forward. None of these releases were marked. So all these programs are eyed eggs, obviously too small to have any sort of marking. So their contribution to the fisheries, as well as their survival rates, the amount of straying that happens onto the spawning grounds, all those things at this point in time are unknown. We also have a history of net pen releases in Willapa Bay. The earliest that I could find was 1972, although you get back that far and sometimes hatchery records can be a little shaky. The last release was in 1998. In between that time, we've had net pens in South Bend, at Bay Center, at Nakata. They've released Chinook, Coho, and Chum, and even in 1 year, we had 5,000 pinks that were released in Willapa Bay and Johnson Slough. Some of these releases had been tagged in the past, and they did contribute to both recreational and commercial fisheries, as well as some recoveries on the spawning grounds and at the hatcheries. Not substantial contributions, but they were there. Some of the issues with these programs and some of the reasons why they've been discontinued: predation control was a big issue out in the bay. Hard time keeping the seals and other things out of there. disease, not only within the population, and then there was also some fear of spreading disease to natural origin fish. And there was some concern about the organic waste in terms of excess feed and then also the fish waste itself. So some of the applicable RCWs that we have that go into ocean ranching, this first one here basically states that private ocean ranching in the state of Washington is not authorized. There's also a stipulation within that RCW that any released smolts are property of the state. The second one is basically our McKernan Hatchery Agreement, the department partnership agreements to operate and manage certain hatcheries. This happens at the Chum Hatchery in Hood Canal, McKernan. It also says that any nonprofit, for-profit, or federally recognized tribe are eligible to apply to run these facilities if we do have them. The last would be the RCW dealing with our regional fisheries enhancement groups. It just basically states that they can operate on a non-for-profit basis. Some of their revenue, the revenue from surplus fish sales, returns to the facility to continue funding these programs. And kind of the basis behind these programs is to improve salmon resources for all citizens of the state. Some of the potential benefits that can be realized from ocean ranching programs. You have involvement with the local community in terms of co-op associations, and they are provided a conservation incentive to work with these programs. There is an opportunity to increase catch by releasing more fish. It provides alternatives in mixed stock fisheries. Can provide an alternative. In terms of government cost, if we were to raise and release these fish on their own, obviously that would be more costly. Ocean ranching program would reduce government cost. In terms of the carcasses, fish coming back and on the spawning grounds, you have the benefit there of some additional marine-derived nutrients. And if you're talking about chum or pink programs, those small smolts, when released, could serve as a prey base also for coho and chinook smolts. Some of the issues that have been identified are impacts to wild fish. You have competition for space in terms of rearing strategy. You have impacts on the spawning grounds, straying. You have genetics. So there's also impacts to other natural resource programs, in terms of net pens, you have the shellfish would be a big one that would be impacted. There's also the fear of disease, not only within the program itself, but also to natural origin fish. Some of that organic waste in terms of excess feed and fish waste could lead to degradation of habitat, specifically water quality issues. There's some water right issues here, too. In some of these areas, we're not seeing quite the flows that we used to see at the time of year that we're seeing them, and water is becoming tighter and tighter between fish and agriculture and other needs. A long-term source of funding would need to be identified to help run these programs. And their economic viability, I think, is really unclear. At this point, I would say that there hasn't been a program that's been operated for profit that has shown success. But some nonprofit style programs, it depends on what side of the fence you come down on. So just to kind of sum things up. There are multiple forms of ocean ranching are used around the world. It's done many different places. I think the economics of this is really unclear at this point in time, at least for facilities that are operated on a nonprofit basis. Currently not legal in the state of Washington, so there are some hurdles to overcome there. The startup and monitoring and evaluation that goes along with some of these type of programs can be very costly in terms of initial startup. There are benefits in terms of increasing harvest. That is pretty clear. There are some definite ecological benefits, and there are some issues with these style programs. And I think one of the big ones is the interaction between hatchery and wild fish moving forward. And so that's about all I got. I think I went pretty close to time. Commissioner Mencken, I also have your box with me. Still in pristine order, too.
Questions?
So for a place like Willapa or Grace Harbor, you have hatchery programs already there. How would you benefit from what you've learned with regard to sea ranching worldwide that you could use to maybe bolster production at a lower cost in, say, either one of those bays?
That's a difficult question to answer. I think from my standpoint, if I could speak honestly, we've instituted a lot of changes in Willapa in the last 5 years with the initial draft management policy in 2010 and the policy that was signed in 2015. I think it would be beneficial to tread very carefully and collect some data on how those changes are affecting the bay and really move forward very cautiously. Alaska's program, most of their hatcheries are operated right at tidal, right in the tidal area. Currently, we don't have facilities that could facilitate that. I think there is some definite infrastructure that would need to take place, as well as a lot of monitoring and evaluation. We would have to tread very carefully there. I'm not sure I have a recommendation right at this time for how we would move forward that way. Not that I wouldn't be opposed to that, but I think it would take some considerable effort.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are economic problems and biological problems associated with it, but I'm not so certain that they couldn't be overcome in some cases with some species.
I would agree.
If you're talking about economic viability, for example, you've got to ask the same question about public hatchery systems in the state as they exist today. Are they economically viable, or are they an artificial means of bolstering, both recreational and commercial fisheries? And in that respect, are they economically viable?
Yeah, I think your point's right on. I think there's still a lot of work we need to do within Willapa Bay even to answer those basic questions about the programs that we currently have.
And then the other question, of course, is what has occurred to the things like nonprofits and sea ranches worldwide? They've often ended up in culture systems like floating net pen systems for certain species that are amenable to that type of culture. For example, if you look worldwide at Atlantic salmon culture, which takes place in two places primarily, which is Norway and Chile, those operations are highly profitable. They produce over 1 million metric tons of farmed salmon annually, and they have evolved into systems that are relatively safe and predictable. If you compare that 1 million metric tons a year to the total harvest of Pacific salmon in the North Pacific, it exceeds it almost annually. There are some years in recent years where they were just very close to being the same. But by and large, Atlantic salmon farming and floating net cages, which is also under fire in the United States, but not so much in places like Norway and Chile, where in both cases those farming systems are worth over $1 billion annually, and we don't do it here except on a very, very small basis. Yep. So there's still some potential out there.
Yeah, no, I would agree. We could use, the template of what those programs are and take a close look at that. I wouldn't shut the door on this completely, but I think a lot of work needs to be done before we got to a point where we were actually discussing implementing any of these.
Yeah. Well, you delved into a really complex area, lots of information out there on it, and you did a good job.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm proud of you.
Ranking.
Thank you. And for a guy like you, do you know what your name means, of course? Chad Herring.
It's or as I'm sometimes referred to as Two Fish.
It's True Fish. There is a term out there that it denotes that you become what your name is.
It's interesting, as I started my career on the herring spawning project.
Anyway, good job.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Chad, are you aware of any companies from the private sector that have been snooping around or have any interest in this scenario?
Yes, I have talked to one individual who would be interested. He's quite an elderly gentleman now, but he does have some interest in researching this farther and interest in pursuing a for-profit enterprise.
What species?
That he's not really sure of. So, you know, just had a very preliminary conversation with this gentleman.
Thank you.
Miranda.
I think you're Dick Wilson.
Yes, I am.
And Dick and I worked together developing a proposal on ocean ranching, and he was interested in chum. And I brought this issue forward and requested this blue sheet request to hear this briefing because I've got a number of images in my mind about where we're headed in Willapa. I think we all recognize the challenges of increasing our funding. We heard about the fee increase proposal this morning. And if we are unsuccessful in getting funding to fill in for some of the reductions that have been taking place, our hatchery production is going to decline. So the initial thought was that we have to find ways to reduce the cost of producing fish to the government. And the private sector may be one of the solutions. But I'm not. But I didn't have the expectation that we would shift the scale of production to a for-profit hatchery-like operation. My image was that maybe this ocean ranching could be a piece of the solution. Maybe not even a big piece, but giving private entrepreneurs like Dick Wilson, who did operate an ocean ranching facility in Willapa in the 70s, that's the one you're referring to, he feels like it was very successful. And he'd never expected to make a complete living off of ocean ranching. He's an oyster grower, too. So his image currently, and he has a son who's very interested in it. It's not just elderly Dick.
Yeah.
The image was that maybe if we could encourage some entrepreneurs in Willapa, we could get some private sector energy behind some small-scale ocean ranching operations that could pay for themselves, maybe not a lot above that. We could regulate time, place, and manner, species, and chum was on the table too because in Willapa, there's a strong feeling among the locals that Willapa is generally a chum environment. And the chum stocks have declined from dramatically from historic levels. So there's room for more chum. There used to be more chum. And if you place those chum operations, you make them the right scale, they may not have the wild fish interactions that we would worry about. So when I asked for this briefing, it was to start delving into the specifics. I don't think there's anything insuperable. And I think as we go down the road of looking for additional funding for our hatcheries, we we might not get any public funding. We may need to look at these alternatives. But my final statement will be that this is not something that I'm finding broad support for in Pacific County. So I don't know that the timing is right at the moment. However, there's so many hurdles to get over to plan this sort of thing. If it is our expectation that hatchery funding is going to continue to decline, and that is a good possibility, we should be thinking about alternatives. We should be planning for alternatives. That was my point.
And I concur with that.
I would agree.
Any other questions or comments?
I just have a question. I don't even know who I want to address it to. One of the slides way back there, you put up the fact that the RCWs restrict a situation like this. I guess one of the things I'd like to know is there a champion out there that would, in the legislature that would consider doing it? I think that's one of the most important steps, is if it could be blessed legislatively, then it might be something to consider. But I also, as my colleagues, Commissioner Wecker and Mencken mentioned, I'm very concerned about the funding situation in the near future as it relates to a predicted recession that's coming next year, perhaps, and so on. So, any thoughts on that? Anybody?
Thank you.
Hi, Ron.
Commissioner Carpenter, thanks for the question. Ron Warren, Fish Program, for the record. I think it would take a champion. I think that if we were going to continue to invest time in this, we'd want to make sure that we had local advocates, people that were going to participate either in the ocean ranching process itself and or the harvest of fish that return there. It's with them that the champion would be born. Because if the constituents want it, I'm going to guess that there could be some support depending on the sideboards or constraints that are put along with it. So whether it's Willapaw or Grace Harbor or a Puget Sound estuary somewhere, it would have to be done in a way where we had some public outreach to seek participants. And from the participants would come, I think, the legislative champions that may be able to get the bill introduced and see it through for to pass.
Thank you.
Yeah. I guess in the same vein that Larry, why were the laws in the first place to guard against net pens like they have in Canada or something? Do you know, Conrad?
Yeah, it was general opposition coming from the environmental community. And in most cases, like in Alaska, the fishermen in Alaska feared net pen culture of any species of salmonid up there as competition to the wild harvest. So they thought that it would affect the bottom line with regard to what they were making on their in their fishery. As it turns out, it probably was and I don't think there's any question it was a great economic boost to the capture fishery, because the capture fishery became kind of select items, and the prices in general went up on the capture fishery. Along with the worldwide production of farmed salmon, so I don't think at this point that the capture fishery has been harmed by world production of farmed salmon, because it did go away. I mean, it went in effect from the United States. It was done in Maine. It was done in the state of Washington. Still done in the state of Washington, to a lesser extent in the state of Maine. Those operations are profitable, but they're not competitive, really, with capture fisheries.
So the
bottom line here was that there was so much opposition to sea ranching and salmon farming that the legislature went along with the suggestion of outlawing it.
So in that vein, if it was proposed right, then maybe we could get away from that, because there again, you're not talking to net pens per se. This is
this is not salmon farming, but
right.
Sea ranching had less opposition because the capture fishery would benefit from the harvest. I think the big thing that killed it here in the Pacific Northwest, and especially in Oregon, was the fact that Weyerhaeuser, the company that was involved in sea ranching in Oregon, primarily of coho, could not control the harvest, and so it was a free for all when the fish came back to the release sites in Oregon. So it was not economically viable in Oregon.
I've heard in Willapog, this is all secondhand information, I wasn't around in those days, was that there was real conflict over between the commercial fishers who wanted to maintain the kind of system we had in place where the state would enhance the fish, would supplement the fish, and then the commercial fishers would have an opportunity to catch them. They opposed the a system in which a private ocean rancher might have a claim to those fish that were produced, so that there would be then competition or conflict over the harvest of those fish between the commercial fishers who were basically out there, trying to catch the state's fish versus the private proprietary interest in the fish on the part of the fish ocean rancher. So it was getting complicated there, and Dick Wilson tells me that he thinks it was his view that it didn't matter if the commercial fishers took whatever fish they could, intercepted them before the ones that made it back to the ocean ranch got back. He didn't mind that quite a few of those fish were caught. So to him, it wasn't a big issue. But he tells me that the commercial fishermen were worried about this idea of turning some portion of the run into a privately owned portion that should go back to the person who raised them.
Yeah, bear in mind, of course, that the Alaskan system of nonprofit hatcheries is just exactly that.
I don't know how long we can go on with this, but I think it's an interesting dialogue. What we're talking about here is chum salmon, I believe. I mean, chum salmon are not going to be intercepted by a recreational fishery because, for all intents and purposes, they don't bite. The value of chum salmon over the last decade has gone up a lot. I guess I'd be interested if we can drill down a little bit more on the possibility, if it's even viable, what a chum salmon economic model would look like, and see if it even makes sense. And I'm not sure I'm giving you any direction other than talking out loud to what I'm thinking.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner Carpenter. I think that it wouldn't take much to look at collection of chum broodstock to formulate some base of egg take. We've certainly done exercises in the state to look at different production levels and different species. To give you an idea, way back when, we looked at should NEMA be a coho or Chinook facility, or should we raise chum there. If we converted it to a chum facility, it's got a capacity to raise and release 22 million chum. So there are lots of different exercises we could run through to give some kind of basis if commission so desired.
I think, just to go a little bit farther with that, the commercial fishery and or the sea ranching entity most likely would harvest a fish in Willapop Bay. And the timing of chum is probably, what, November there?
October.
So when they get in Willapa Bay, they're probably already going to be turning color, I would expect, to some degree. And the eggs are where most of the value is in the chum salmon. And in this overview that you're going to do, I guess I'd kind of want to know what you would do with the carcasses. I mean, you probably know now, but I'm just wondering if they have any value for human consumption or what?
Correct. And that would be part of an analysis that we could do.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Chad Herring, thank you.
Thank you for your time.